Ian, shall we start with the second sacking of the former head of crime intelligence in the Western Cape?
So, Chris, absolutely. I think it's something that we have, that I have welcomed. From a committee point of view, we've welcomed. It's something that we've really been fighting about quite a bit. You'd remember last year at the beginning of December, the South African Police Service revoked the dismissal of the previous head of crime intelligence in the Western Cape. He was dismissed in August of 2024. And then suddenly we hear about it being revoked. And after a very heated, and let's rather call it a robust discussion with the National Commissioner, the Minister, the entire committee, and the management of SAPS, I must say, I need to commend the South African Police Service for actually then handling it with urgency. So he was dismissed this past Monday. And I think that he will try and fight it. I wouldn't be surprised. Remember that there are a lot of questions about alleged misconduct regarding the abuse of power, the abuse of state resources for a non-sanctioned investigation, the loss and theft, rather theft of his service pistol, laptop, assault, kidnapping charges. There's a whole list of question marks around the individual, the damage done within the South African Police Service regarding the individual has been significant. And if you speak to members that have been impacted directly or indirectly by this person, and you go and look in the region, geographic region of operation of the family, etc., then there are even more doubtful things that would certainly have a negative impact on SAPS and obviously public trust. Our current crime intelligence environment is not one that is healthy.
Several times in Parliament, I called the VIP8 thugs. And that is exactly what they are. They are thugs. They behave themselves as such. They are an embarrassment to many good career police members, and there is no justification for what they did. Now, from both Pop Crew and unfortunately SAPU as well, they are very aggrieved now, because how dare I call them thugs? And Pop Crew tried last week in a little bit of a cheap attempt at a police officer's funeral, which makes it even worse, to say that they called me the white boy, thinking that he's the chairperson of the police or something like that. And I take it from who it comes, so I don't have sleepless nights over those types of comments. But they then said that, how dare I call police thugs? Now, everyone knows, anyone that does puts in a little bit of effort to do just a little bit of research knows how incredibly enthusiastic and passionate I am about good policing, and how many police officers I've had fantastic relationships with. So I would never make a sweeping statement like that. But when it comes to rogue cops, I would, and I stand by that. And in a parliamentary context, as part of my constitutional duty to do oversight, I'm not going to allow any union to make me look or seem or feel like just being a rubber stamp that needs to simply approve anything they say or do. There's something very wrong with the process that was followed here, and it's critical for us to dissect it. In a country with the murder rate that we have and such a low detection rate, surely the very tools that are often used to kill people, namely illicit firearms, need to be at zero losses when it comes to the very custodians of law enforcement in the country, namely the South African Police Service. The research that I like to refer to is the research done by Professor Rudolf Zinn. In my opinion, probably the person that has done the most direct research with regards to farm attacks in South Africa, has spent significant time interviewing the actual convicts, the convicted felons that are now in correctional centers, about why and how, what was the motive behind the attack. And Zinn went and he interviewed tens, if not close to 100 of these felons, and spoke with them about why they didn't. It's very interesting. He spoke to them about the modus operandi as well. Now, a few things stood out. The one was that they look at victims that are supposedly weaker than your general kind of person in the public. So they usually look for older victims. They look for maybe a woman that lives on a farm alone, or maybe with children. But they go and look who a victim might be that is more vulnerable, generally more vulnerable. The perception that Zim came to, or Zim discovered when questioning these felons, was also that there's a perception that they think that farmers in South Africa all have large amounts of cash, one, and two, large amounts of firearms. Now, along with that, there's a perception, and it's very often a very accurate one, that help is a long way away. In other words, it's an isolated type of incident, not isolated in the sense that it doesn't happen often. It's isolated in the sense that you're far away from help. They know that police, neighbors, etc., would take a very long time to get there. And then two, it happened quite regularly that there's some form of internal information that they receive. Not necessarily always an inside job as such, but that people are threatened over a long period of time. They would go to a tavern, for example, local tavern. They would drink there. People would ask them about the farm that they work at. And so these attackers would gather information. Another part that was very interesting was that the attackers would actually sometimes go and store the weapons or whatever tools they might use during the attack weeks already before the actual attack. They would go and hide it. They would dig holes, you know, close it up in a hole and hide it on the farm for when they are going to go and commit the crime. And then another interesting part is that they would actually do reconnaissance, sometimes up to weeks ahead of the attack, to plan how they were going to do this. Obviously, there's a risk. If they think there are firearms, they might know or think that those firearms could be used on them. So they need to plan properly. So that's the practical summary of how the attacks generally happen, how they look. But then there's a critical part with regards to the disproportionate force that is often seen in farm attacks. Now, people can say whatever they want. They can debate genocide or not genocide. We can get to that still. To me, the critical point is that disproportionate force and violence is often seen in farm attacks, where you would have an urban robbery that would last 5 to 15 minutes. I have personally visited a farm attack scene where an attack and the torture lasted up to 11 hours, where victims, and I always use the example, it was extremely disturbing, where his nail marks were stuck in the carpets from how they dragged him through the house, torturing him over and over and throughout an entire night to get access to whatever they thought he had. Now, there are many examples of that, but there's definitely a disproportionate force. Now, what I came across over the years, that some victims had told me, some of them would understand whatever the language was that the suspects would be using. And very often the suspects would actually start quarreling amongst each other while they are doing the attack. So one would say, boil the water. We want more. You know, we want to get cash or weapons or whatever it might be. The other would say, we're not here for that. We're not going to torture people. And they would quarrel and bicker amongst each other. And then very often it leads to that point. Other times, of course, it starts like that immediately. In parts of the Western Cape, as an example, we don't often see torture happening, although it has definitely happened. It's not necessarily the same way that we see in other provinces. And so the dynamics change. What makes a farm attack unique, apart from the disproportionate violence, is one, it's the only one, that the only violent crime in South Africa that is politically encouraged, where certain people, and you know who I'm talking about, can continue to sing songs that encourage killing. They can sugarcoat it all they like. It is hate speech, and it is incitement of violence. And whoever doesn't see that, including some of our courts, I'm extremely concerned about the compass used to determine that it is just purely freedom of speech. It cannot be that in a democratic country where we're aiming for a democratic, sustainable future, that is allowed.
Ian, please recap for us those explosive allegations made by the KwaZulu-Natal provincial commissioner against the Minister of Police and a deputy national commissioner.
Yeah, so Chris, it was an unprecedented moment what happened yesterday. I'm not aware of anything like it that has happened in the country before. Now, before I get to the opinion of it, he basically said that the Minister of Police and the Deputy National Commissioner have direct contact with certain very well-renowned underworld figures. One specific one that he mentioned was, for example, Kat Motlala or Mushimushi Motlala. Now, Motlala, very interestingly, you'd remember a few months ago, the owner of the AM Royal Football Club's house was raided by SARS. And a lot of the firearms that were found at that property belonged to a security company registered under Kat Motlala. Very interesting. When I questioned Sira about it, it actually started on a social media thing. I said to them, but there are significant regulatory transgressions here. And they just said there's nothing. They did an investigation, no regulatory transgressions. I said to them, but surely the services must be suspended. I mean, he didn't store the firearms in the right place. And they just answered and said, no, he was just renting space to keep guns there. I mean, it's unheard of. Not only is it regulatory transgression in terms of CIRA, it's a significant criminal it's criminal misconduct. We're talking about like high-end, high-caliber firearms here. Nevertheless, no real formal answer was ever received by CIRA despite questioning it. And then after that, also wrote a whole set of parliamentary questions to the minister regarding Kat Motlala, because there's this history of links to cash and transit heist, the Tembisa hospital issue, Gauteng Health Department. I mean, there are scores of things that one can zoom in on. And unfortunately, no answer was received up until now. Now, I must be honest with you, objectively speaking, it's first of all critical that all parties relevant to this and what happened yesterday get a fair chance to state their case. It's important that we don't engage in trial by media or trial by social media. We've seen the damage that can do. That being said, I would find it very shocking that a provincial commissioner like General Konazi would take the risk, both physical and in terms of his job, his entire career, would take the risk that he took yesterday if he didn't have something to back it up with. It comes back to, one, the president. It comes back to the Minister of Police and to the National Commissioner of Police. Those three people should be held accountable for the disaster that we're currently in.
Ian, please take us through the horror experience yesterday.
Sure. So, Chris, it's not a very long story. We did a surprise visit at the Philippi Training Academy of the South African Police Service. And when we completed our visit, we were on our way back to the airport to drop Lisa, a fellow MP, at the airport. She was sitting in the back of the vehicle, and Nicholas Gottsell, my fellow MP as well, sitting in the front next to me. I was driving and the road was quite congested. That part of Nyanga or Philippi East is problematic. I've been working in the area for over 5 years. I know the area well, and we know the risks there. The traffic started piling up. Municipal Bucky from City of Cape Town stopped next to us, and while they're working, one of the drivers said to us, you guys really need to be careful here. And I said to him, no, we know, we've been here before. And Lisa just said, something doesn't feel right. And when she said that, obviously you immediately are even more alert. And it was in a space of seconds. And they broke the window on my side. And shortly after that, me and the guy that was trying to get in on my side was like, I was trying to keep him out, and he kept on coming and kept on like hitting, I don't know what he had. I'm guessing it was another brick, but the brick that he broke in with was already inside the car. It was on my lap. And I was pushing him away, and then I just heard another shot on the other side, not a gunshot, just a noise, a loud noise. Looked around, and they had hit Nicholas on his head, a very, very bad wound. He was just covered in blood. His whole face was covered in blood. His clothes was covered in blood. And at that very moment, they hit Lisa's side as well. So there were two guys trying to get in on that side. Nick fell down to his lap with his head. Tried to defend us with what we had, and we managed to escape. But it was, quite a scary experience. They just kept coming. It was like nothing would scare them off, you know. We all threw punches and were fighting back, and they never managed to steal anything. But they were very determined to get into the vehicle.
At what stage did you get to your firearm?
So I probably when Nick dropped down to his lap, I knew that it was, and that's the only opportunity that we had. They kept coming, and Nick was definitely losing a lot of blood. At that stage, from what I recall, leant over, reached for it, I pushed him down, and then did what needed to be done. And that was it. Then we sped off to the closest petrol garage. And at the petrol garage, we parked in a way that we could still see any oncoming threat because it was still close by. So we were scared that they would come back. And we then immediately started calling for emergency services help. Lisa spoke with Crisis on Call to arrange the medical emergency services. So there was a really good response from both ER24 and Metro EMS. Metro Police from the City of Cape Town reacted very, very quickly. And local SAPs, Philippi East SAP specifically, and Nyanga SAPs were phenomenal. They were very, very quick. And then specifically City of Cape Town Metro Police, and also CPI, the private security company, also came through. Initially, what was a humbling part of it is that people didn't know initially that it was us. You just call for help. And it was really amazing to see the compassion and the enthusiasm with which everyone arrived there. Investigation, let's take its course. We're not going to stop doing our work. And I don't say it in a melodramatic way. We're not deterred. I spoke with Nicholas this morning, and both of us were joking that we, tongue in cheek, are even more attractive now. We were joking, and Lisa is just incredible. She's like a little matriarch to the two of us. So yesterday she was extremely caring. We felt like her kids. Chris, I don't know what the motive was. The charges seem to be attempted murder and attempted robbery or hijacking. The police are on their way to see me now, so then I'll learn exactly what the charges are that they're looking at. But again, gonna do our jobs. It's not gonna stop us, whether it was targeted or not. We're gonna continue doing what we do.
What would the worst possible outcome be for the ordinary citizen if this became law? We'll obviously go through the bill soon.
Yeah, so Chris, let's just give background. So in 2021, we had this proposed amendment bill that came forward, and the response was tremendous. I mean, over 100,000, objections, or mainly objections, were submitted. With regards to the bill, it was an absolute nightmare for any person that thought they could just arbitrarily remove people's firearms in South Africa, especially for self defense. So if I can give you some background, or very briefly,
what it basically says, or three of the critical things that stand out, is one, you would basically lose your ability to get a Section 13 or a self-defense firearm unless there are extreme circumstances under which you can motivate such. So you literally would depend on the stroke of a pen from a minister to determine whether you could have a firearm for self-defense. Now, the majority of firearm owners in South Africa, a large majority of them, are firearm owners because of the critical need of being able to defend yourself, because the state doesn't have the capacity to. The second one is that you would have a very limited amount or access of a limited amount of firearms under Section 16, or as we all know, it's called it's under Section 16 of the Firearm Control Act, but also known for being the dedicated sport or hunter's accreditation. And that would pose a severe limit to people that practice sport shooting or professional hunting, for that matter. And the third one is just the general harsh restrictions that we would see on private security companies. It's interesting also to understand that this is an orchestrated attempt to disarm private persons and the private sector. There's no doubt. And it's ironic that this 2021 piece of so-called history has now been brought to the fore once again. From what we could find out, it's virtually exactly the same thing, despite all the objections. And this happens just after they announced regulatory changes in the private security regulatory space. We are now starting to try and overregulate the people that are not the problem, but we're not tackling the actual issue, which is fixing corruption in the South African police service. It will not stop violent crime. It will only make communities more vulnerable. And that's something the majority of lawfully armed citizens in South Africa just simply won't allow. We are going to protect our communities. We're going to protect ourselves and our families. And there's no way that we're going to allow them to arbitrarily take that away.